Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last November, after a football game in Orlando, college student Robert Champion was beaten so badly in a hazing incident that he died of his injuries. He was not in a fraternity or on the football team. He was a drum major in the Florida A&M University marching band, the famous Marching 100. Now 13 people are facing criminal charges connected with Champion's death, 11 felony charges. And hazing goes on. The brutal practice continues to be a problem on campuses nationwide. This hour on Point, a death by hazing and why hazing doesn't quit. You can join the conversation. Have you been hazed, been a hazer yourself? Why? How could it, should it be stopped? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Orlando, Florida, is Denise Bologna, senior reporter for the Orlando Sentinel newspaper. She's been all over the Robert Champion case. Denise, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Take us back to November and what happened on that night. Who was Robert Champion and what was going on when he got on the bus where the beating took place?
Sure. Robert was a talented musician who had, you know, been involved with music since he was very young. He traveled with the marching band to perform at the Florida Classic last November. The Florida Classic is a really big deal for the school. It's a big fundraiser, and it ends the season for the football team. Students performed at the Classic. They get on their buses. They go back to their hotel rooms. And then later in the evening, a crowd of students and alumni get on a bus for the specific purpose of hazing. And from what we understand, most of it we've gotten from the Champion family attorney, he's done his own investigation, so a lot of what we know we got from him. But what happened was there was a series of rituals that Robert and one or two other students went through that night, and it involved very violent.
There was a ritual called Crossing Bus C. What was that about?
Yeah, Crossing Bus C is a ritual that the student starts at the very front of the bus, and the goal is to reach the back and touch the back of the bus. Mm-hmm. But they're going to go through a heck of a lot to get there. They're being punched. They're being kicked. They're being pounded with items, including instruments. They're being held back. That the crowd is just attacking them all at once. They might fall down, and if you fall to the floor, you got to start at the front again.
Oh. And there was Robert Champion, 6 feet tall, 235 pounds, 26 years old. This is no little guy, but that's quite a path to pass. What kind of injuries did he end up with?
The medical examiner says that his body was covered in injuries, contusions all over his chest, his stomach, his back, hemorrhaging. They ruled that his death was blunt force trauma because of the extension, hemorrhaging, and contusion by hazing. That they ruled it was death by hazing.
Now, the Marching 100, the Florida A&M band, is a big deal. I mean, they've been in Super Bowl halftimes, played with Kanye West at the Grammys. They were featured on 60 Minutes. They played when President Obama was inaugurated. What about this hazing ritual? Is it part of, a long time part of, the Florida A&M tradition?
Yeah, as far as we know, yes. We've seen complaints going back years from parents, students, others, asking the school to be more aggressive, complaining about hazing specifically within the marching band. We know that between fall of 2007 and the end of last year, that the university police department itself investigated at least 10 cases of hazing within the marching band specifically. But this is a really prestigious group. This is a group that students, they really want to show their dedication to the group. They really want to be a part of this group. It's a big deal for the school.
But they know. I mean, it's clear from those police reports and from history. At a clarinetist who was just beaten until beaten bloody, big settlement there. You had Marcus Parker, who went into renal failure in 2001 after his hazing with this band. He was awarded $1.8 million in a lawsuit against band members. That sounds like gigantic warning flares.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the university tells me that they have been trying really hard to stop this. And, you know, we know that at the beginning of every school year for years, they hold a workshop for the marching band specifically to go over the law and the repercussions, the penalties. You're going to get kicked out of school. You're going to lose your scholarship. At the very least, if there's an allegation that you have been involved, even if you've participated, you're going to get suspended from the band. So they're repeatedly told that this is serious. The university is trying to take this seriously, but they're doing it in the wee hours of the morning sometimes off campus, in addition to the stuff that they're experiencing on campus during practice.
Here's Pam Champion, the mother of Robert Champion, who died in the incident in November, talking with CBS News last Wednesday, saying that everybody responsible for her son's death should be held to account.
Rob loved that school. He loved that band. And they all failed him. All of them failed him. So they should be held accountable. We've always said that everybody, whether you were directly or indirectly, should be held accountable for what you did or did not do.
What you did or did not do on that bus that night and maybe beyond. Denise, tell us more about Robert Champion. I mean, he had been an outspoken opponent of hazing. He was also gay and openly gay. He was one of half a dozen drum majors with the band. That's a very prominent position and was in line to be the lead drum major, maybe the most prestigious role on the band, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the drum major, those are the leads for the
sure.
band. They're responsible for keeping everybody in order and helping, you know, make sure everyone's doing what they're supposed to be doing. He was gay. I'm not sure whether he was openly gay. I mean, some people knew, some people didn't, according to the students that we've spoken to. But the fact that he was gay does not appear to be a big deal in the band. I mean, from what I understand, there are a number of gay students in the band. So the people I spoke to say that really wouldn't have been a big deal.
Yet one wonders, he had been outspoken against hazing, but then he decided to go in and make this walk. I mean, this wasn't the bus he was riding on, so he deliberately went to bus C. And there's been speculation that that was because after holding out for so long, he was in line to be the lead drum major, and he wanted full acceptance by the rest of the group. What do we know about why he went there on that night?
Yeah, we don't know why. We don't know exactly why. Some of the students we've spoken to, you know, they're kind of offering opinions. They think that, you know, he was a guy who really, really wanted the respect of everyone. He was going to be the head drum major. And crossing bus C was a hazing ritual specific to the percussion section. And since the drum majors themselves didn't have their own kind of subgroup and hazing rituals, they went through the bus C initiation. And he, you know, maybe wanted to do it specifically to show that, you know, he was loyal, he was dedicated, and he wanted everyone to respect him and you know, follow what he had to say.
Last week, charges against 13. What charges?
Felony charges for most of them, 11. 11 people, felony charges. Two of them were misdemeanor charges, were only misdemeanor charges. 11 were felony. 11 of them got felony in addition to two counts of misdemeanor each, and then the remaining two were only misdemeanor charges.
And the felony charges, what were they, or what was it?
We don't have those details yet. We're calling every day trying to get more details, but from what I understand, the felonies were specifically connected to Mr. Champion's death, and the misdemeanor charges, or at least many of them, probably are connected to the one or two other students who were hazed aboard the bus with him that evening.
But they're not murder or manslaughter charges. The family's been unhappy about that. Here was the Florida State Attorney General Lawson Lamar announcing charges against 13 in that death, and when he did it last week on Wednesday, also speaking out against the tradition of hazing.
No one could have expected that his college experience would include being pummeled to death, an event that some early on mistakenly called a rite of passage. I have come to believe that hazing is a term for bullying. It's bullying with a tradition that we cannot bear in America.
The Florida State Attorney last week, Lawson Lamar. So where does the band stand at this point? What happened to the rest of its season? What about its director? How's Florida A&M handling all this, Denise?
Sure. The band has been suspended since very shortly after Mr. Champion's death, and the school is actually trying to figure out when and if to lift that suspension. They're already making plans to figure out what kind of entertainment to offer should the band not perform in the fall. So that's where they're going with that. The band director, he's still on paid administrative leave. He's trying to get back into the classroom. Hasn't had any success so far. He's, you know, arguing that, you know, that the things that happened to Mr. Champion were no fault of his, and that he has tried aggressively for a while to prevent and stop hazing with the band, and has been met with, basically he's saying that the administration hasn't taken his warnings and his requests for help seriously. But the school itself has taken some steps. For example, a few months ago, the president announced that he was suspending all recruitment activities for all student organizations on campus, not just the band, not just fraternities. They have also formed a committee, a national committee of experts to try to help the school figure out how to get rid of hazing.
Denise, we've got to break it there. We've got a break coming up. We're grateful to you. We're going to dive right on into the big hazing challenge. But Denise Bellona with the Orlando Sentinel, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Listeners, you can join us. What do you think of this story in hazing on campuses in this country? 800-423-8255. Behind us, the Florida A&M band. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about hazing on American college campuses and the death of drum major Robert Champion at Florida A&M. Homicide by hazing, and why hazing just does not seem to quit. Here's Christopher Chestnut, the Champion family attorney, in a press conference near the family home in Atlanta last Thursday, saying there was a long history of hazing at Florida A&M. Despite the arrests earlier in the week and charges brought, justice, he said, had still not been done.
There is a long history of hazing in the band at FAMU. And obviously, through the decades of this tradition, there has not been sufficient accountability or consequences because it continues. Unfortunately, it appears that today, that tradition continues because there's been no appropriate sanctioning for the murder of Robert Champion.
Not enough, says the family's attorney. Lots of people talking about it at Florida A&M. Of course, here's graduate student Stan Barnes telling the Tallahassee Democrat that he hoped the 13 charges brought against 13 in the Champion case would help to end the culture of hazing at the school.
The hazing practices, they need to come to an end for organizations like bands and fraternities. What they do for initiations, they should try to do more positive things versus, you know, continuing this, you know, string of violence like, you know, beating people in like gangs do. We're in college. We need to be civilized people.
Need to be civilized people. Not everybody's at all confident it will happen. In December, Kofi Hemingway, a recent Florida A&M grad who played in the marching band, explained to CBS News why hazing remained one of the band's traditions.
Unfortunately, it's kind of like that book, Lord of the Flies, you know, where you have young people, young minds that a lot of times are unmonitored and unsupervised.
Yeah, and Robert Champion is dead, and many others have been traumatized. Many others have died. Joining me now from Franklin, Indiana, is Hank Neuer. He's a professor of journalism at Franklin College, has made the study of hazing his life's work. He's written four books on the subject and kept a running tally of American hazing deaths going all the way back to the 19th century. Hank Neuer, welcome to On Point.
Good to be on the program.
Why does hazing happen?
It happens because individuals want so much to be part of a group and to have that kind of camaraderie. A person I interviewed a long time ago was Irving Janis, the groupthink theory, saying that basically people will act in a group the way they would not as individuals. And because the band was a high-status group, people were willing to do whatever it took to get in and to do whatever it took to keep someone out that they felt didn't measure up.
44 states in this country have anti-hazing laws, and yet I'm looking here, this is a 2008 University of Maine study that concluded that 55% of students who joined fraternities, sororities, sports teams, or other student groups experience it. So a lot of law, but a lot of hazing at the same time.
Right. Most of the laws in this country basically do not have fangs. The toughest law, and that's why this may be getting some attention, would be Florida, where it can be a felony leading up to 6 years in jail. However, in terms of what the family's asking for, I'm afraid that they would really be making a mistake to ask for a manslaughter charge in that, number one, as another district attorney, a former district attorney told me, it's probably going to be tough to prove that the band actions, that the band members knew that their actions might lead to the death of Robert Champion. In fact, there is a kind of collective ignorance based on the fact that many of them probably went through it themselves.
Does manslaughter mean you have to know that what you're doing will kill someone?
According to this former district attorney, Dave Westall, that's true. And then number two, another thing that will happen is that there had to be some premeditation to do immense harm. In their minds, they were doing what was necessary in order to admit him into their company. And that's part of the unfortunate reason why it's so hard to enforce hazing laws. They've got to be brought forward by the prosecuting attorney exactly right. And number two, the fact that students collectively have a blatant ignorance about the consequences or possible consequence of their action.
You know, but they can't be that ignorant at Florida A&M or many other campuses where there's a long history that you've written a lot about. I mean, you had, the one at Florida A&M who was beaten, paddled 300 times. You've had legs broken. You've had renal failure and nearly a $2 million settlement. With all that going on, it is obvious, is it not, that serious danger is at work?
It's obvious to you because you're a sane person who's outside that group. You're not into that collective mentality. In talking at a different historically African-American university just about 5 weeks ago, not only were there people in the audience who were talking in favor, who were undergraduates talking about the need for hazing, but also a faculty member spoke up until the sister, Brittany Champion, of Robert Champion, happened to be in that audience and spoke out about her feelings about just how wrong it is. So in other words, there either needs to be a paradigm shift in this country to end hazing, or number two, people get a wake-up call when they are finally facing court action or are attending a funeral.
Now, it's by no means, only at Florida A&M, not even close. I mean, we've had these very prominent reports, you know, more than reports, incidents at Cornell and Boston University, and I'm looking here, reports out of University of Dayton and Penn State, and, you can just go right around the country. Is there more hazing going on today, or are we just more attuned to it, more alerted by media to it?
Well, there's everything good is accompanied by trouble, and one of the good things is that I've never seen such a coalition, no matter what the race, no matter what the fraternal organization, no matter what the sports team, at people at the top who've either gotten tired of being sued, tired of having rising insurance rates, or tired of burying people or visiting people in the emergency room. The bad news over here is that it has not reached the undergraduate level, that while incidents are being reported more, we have not, and that's been one of my major issues as an investigative reporter, we have not got uniform crime reports to have the FBI routinely demanding that universities submit any kind of criminal hazing so it can be counted. All we have would be universities that are doing it voluntarily, such as the University of Texas for the last 3 years of hazing incidents, or San Luis Obispo following a death there. We need to have better reporting, and a lot of private liberal arts schools are simply skating on this issue, as are a lot of high schools where educators are trying to handle the situation quietly.
We're going to look more deeply at what makes this happen, what leads to hazing. Hank Neuer is with us from Franklin College in Indiana, kind of national expert on this, and we've got lots of callers with their stories. Hank, let me go to Danielson, Connecticut first today. And John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. What's your story, John?
I was hazed in 1958 at the University of Rhode Island. First, all the brothers, this was for a fraternity initiation. We were stripped naked and examined for our genitals. Genitals were examined by all the fraternity brothers, the members. Then we were taken downstairs, and there's a huge pile of manure, and we were all thrown into it and made to swim around in it, taken out, dressed up. We were all blindfolded, taken out into the middle of the woods somewhere in the University of Rhode Island vicinity, tied to trees, and we had to untie ourselves, get us back out of the woods, and find a phone somewhere to call friends to have them come and pick us up.
John, that was half a century ago. Now, how do you look back on that? What was going on there? Why?
I don't. Well, it was a typical initiation. All the fraternities at the University of Rhode Island had and have hazing as part of the fraternity initiation process.
And do you look back on it in anger, or just that's the way humans are?
How
do you?
Utterly wrong morally, and just humiliating. And you're right; it's anger at its persistence.
John, I appreciate that call and that story. Let me hold it for a moment and get Jamal in Aiken, South Carolina. Jamal, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes. I'm a member of a fraternity, and I went through some really difficult hazing. But my point is that hazing is mainly about payback. The people that are going through, they want to return all of the hazing and all the trouble that they went through. Mm-hmm. They want to apply that pressure to those people that are online. But you know, there's a flip side to it as well, is that once you go through the hazing and you come out and you become a member of that fraternity or that sorority, then you feel a sense of accomplishment as well. I know sometimes it can, you know, get pretty rough and, you know, and people don't like to talk about it, but I think it gives, you know, an individual a sense of accomplishment, you know, whereby they want to return the favor later on.
Yeah, return the favor. But Jamal, I know what you mean, because alumni, weirdly, I'm reading from Hank and others, often are behind-the-scenes supporters of these traditions going on. Let me get one more, and I'll come to you, Hank. Ben in Las Vegas, Nevada. Ben, you're on.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Real briefly, I'd like to make my comments in three layers. I think in a society where animal cruelty is so much looked down upon, cockfighting is prohibited, and yep, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. To do this to human beings is really disgraceful. But I think the universities, campuses, perhaps could get more aggressive by maybe screening these candidates, maybe getting psychologists, psychiatrists involved in the screening before they enter campus.
Yeah.
You know, people want to join the police force, they get very extensive screening, and if they're a bit too harsh, they're barred.
But to join the marching band, I mean, you're going to be screening almost every college member.
Well, you know, you
I take your point, though. I take your point. And you had one more, Ben? You had one more issue there to raise?
Yes, the last issue is perhaps the challenge could be focused in a different direction, coming up, you know, with charity fundraising, so which sorority or which entity, which campus can raise the most or do the best.
Yeah, instead of beating one another, do something good. I mean, the irony is that a lot of these organizations, they may have exactly such activities in addition to the hazing that goes on. Ben, I appreciate your call from Las Vegas. Hank, there's the spectrum. You know, it was done to our caller John many years ago, and he still looks back on it with some kind of dismay. Our caller Jamal said it was terrible, but, you know, there's a sense of accomplishment. And then Ben trying to feel toward solutions here. What do you make of those callers, Hank?
Well, basically, the theory in psychology is there's a reciprocal effect that dominates us all. You return good when you get good. You return bad when you get bad. And there is an awful lot of bad, as your 1958 caller has pointed out. And it is exactly right. What gets the pledges through or the athletes through is that would be the knowledge that they'll be doing it to the new group next year. And it's a kind of laughter or release to know that that's what's going to happen. And unfortunately, there's a one-upsmanship where often the next year somebody adds a new twist. Somebody locks somebody in a trunk. Somebody covers someone with a substance and lights it. Someone takes someone a little deeper in the country or orders a few more shots or two bottles of whiskey instead of one. And so that's what occurs. Now, in terms of the suggestion to give people psychological tests, that's simply unwieldy, but unless you're talking about when people enter college in the first place.
Yeah.
The idea of that might be possible. But the thing about the hazing, however, is that a lot of it is an acquired, something that people would never expect to be doing when they come in at 17 or 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Once they're inside the group, the norms change, what is normal change, and there is a collision of the bizarre and the strange that suddenly seems normal because it's a fraternity thing or an athlete thing, and the new person passes that liminal space into being a member and accepts it.
Tyler Bellick joins us from Plattsburgh, New York, a senior at the State University of New York, Plattsburgh. Tyler, thanks for being here.
Tom, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Tyler, tell us your story. What happened to you?
Tom, I joined my fraternity in spring 2009, and I knew I was going to be hazed. That was the culture of that fraternity. I had no idea to what extent, and it was just some pretty disgusting things. It started off with just greetings and being quizzed on fraternity history and being screamed at and maybe emotionally hazed, and then it got more and more physical as time went on, and some of it was, I remember one time we each got a box of a dozen donuts, me and my five pledge brothers, and all of the custard and jelly was taken out of the donuts, and they were filled up with ketchup and mayonnaise and other condiments, and we had to rush to eat these donuts and eat. If you had to throw up, you had to turn to the person on your right and throw up. Disgusting things like that, eating condiments, eating dog food, being forced to drink nighttime cough syrup so you would hallucinate, and then we would have to fight through it and stay up, so sleep deprivation.
Were you beaten?
I don't think I was ever beaten. I was threatened to be beaten. The house was boarded up. The doors were locked. And I think there was that fear that if you did fight back or resist that you would be beaten. And there was some pushing and shoving and paddling. But I don't think I was beaten physically to a point where...
Of course, paddling and beating is a pretty, I don't know what the difference is exactly. I do know that you ended up being disgusted about this and speaking out. What was the response when you spoke out, Tyler?
I faced a lot of resistance from my fraternity brothers and some people from other Greek organizations on campus, because hazing is something that people don't like to talk about. Everyone knows it's going on. People know what organizations it's happening in, and everyone chooses to be bystanders. They say it's not our business. You know, this is what has been going on for years and years. It's not our place to change it. And I started learning about what a fraternity was really supposed to be, which is values-based organizations with a mission and a purpose. And I realized that hazing goes against everything that a fraternity or sorority claims to be, which is a values-based organization. So when I started speaking up against it, I faced a lot of resistance from my brothers, and some of it was physical, some of it was mental, and they were just very upset that I was, in their opinion, putting their long history of hazing and traditions in danger by speaking out against it.
Do you think it can be made to go away, Tyler, from your personal experience of first receiving it and then speaking against it? Can it be made to go away?
Can what be made to go away? The feeling of...
Hazing.
Can hazing be made to go away? From my personal experience, I've seen a big turnaround on my campus, just starting the conversation and letting people know that hazing is something that needs to be addressed and it's okay to talk about. It doesn't need to be a big secret. I know we've had a couple years now in my fraternity where we haven't had a hazing program, a hazing new member education program. So I think it did go away, and now it's a matter of making that a tradition so that it doesn't come back.
Tyler Bellick at the State University of New York, Plattsburgh. Tyler, thank you for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about hazing on college campuses and the death of drum major Robert Champion at Florida A&M. Homicide by hazing, it's been called, and why hazing just doesn't seem to quit. Hank Neuer is with us from Franklin College in Franklin, Indiana. He's been studying hazing for a long time, author of The Hazing Reader, Wrongs of Passage, High School Hazing, and much more. Hank, let's go to our listeners. They've got stories, and the stories really light it up. James in Statesboro, Georgia. James, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 46 years old now. This was in the mid-80s. I was in a national fraternity at a private college in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And we did all of the above, everything said, had it done to us, did it to others. But what really brought ours to a head was in 1986, we had a pledge that committed suicide.
Mm.
So we had our national headquarters come down to our university, and they set up hazing hotlines. And at the same time, at a big university in the state of Georgia, our same fraternity had used traffic paint to paint a pledge, and evidently the traffic paint had blocked all the pores in his skin, and he almost died.
Oy.
So I think our fraternity was one of the worst of the worst.
Is it better now, James? Do you know if it's better now, or does it go on?
I don't really know from that standpoint. I know that I still am in touch with a lot of my fraternity brothers, and it never comes up, but it was just you take it in stride, and you did it, and you went through it, and there you are.
Yeah, you did it, and you
usually,
go
usually, like you said, it was a lot of alcohol-induced activities. I would definitely add that to it.
You do it, and you go through it, unless you don't make it through it. And you've got a suicide there, and it sounds like some other tough stuff. Here's Robert Champion's dad talking with Good Morning America 3 weeks after his son died about the anguish he felt at that passing.
It's a place in our heart now where it's a void, and I pray that no other kid, no other parent would have to go through what we went through.
A place in their hearts, a void. Jay in Hartford, Connecticut. Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It comes to mind that, the way I was taught, there's a right way and a wrong way to haze as well. In my organization, any brother that was under the influence of any substance was not allowed to participate in pledging. So that's, there's certain common sense things that sort of, help keep things from tipping to the point where it gets out of control.
So where's the line, Jay, between the right and the wrong way to haze? Okay. Somebody's being punched.
Some other examples, there was no physical, striking, mm-hmm. There was corporal things like doing push-ups, things like that.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a thing where the physical stuff is more to get at the mind, mm-hmm. and you sort of, the idea is that you break somebody down and you get them to the point where, afterwards when you come out of it, you really feel stronger. I mean, I remember, going through it and you feel like you can conquer the world. You've been through such a difficult, situation, and you've come through it, you know what I mean? And that is where the bond comes from. That is where, people feel like they have something in common because, hey, you've been through it too. I may not even know you, but I know what you've been through.
Jay, you articulate it very well. I think that's exactly how a lot of people look at the value of the experience. Hank, thank you, Jay. Hank, what are you thinking as you hear that, a right way and a wrong way to haze, and the bonding power of being broken down?
Well, first a disclosure, I said the same thing in 1978 in the first article I wrote about it for Human Behavior after a death occurred at the University of Nevada at Reno and a slew of other deaths that happened in the 70s between 70 and 78. But at this time, I couldn't disagree with myself or with the caller more in that many of the deaths are a single member or two, a couple of renegades who take things all on their own. Number two, you'd be hard-pressed at Florida A&M or any other school that has had a death to have not had some kind of an education program that sets the boundaries, and if people do not want to listen, they're not going to listen. The last death that was in this country was William Torrance at Vincennes in Indiana, and the last hazing speaker to speak at that school right before the death was myself. Mr. Torrance did not attend. His fraternity did not attend. If people do not want to hear or listen, they will not hear and will not listen. And to go back to your original question about how long will it last, I'm now going to be 66 years old. I've been writing about it since the 1970s, and hazing will not end entirely, but it is easing out, and there's never been more thousands of people speaking out. That caller in 1958, had he made a statement then, he would have had university administrators to contend with, national fraternity people, as I did in 1990 when my book Broken Pledges came out. And so that's why the award that's named in my name is called the Anti-Hazing Hero. It's a lot easier for an athlete to face a 98 mile an hour fastball or a linebacker charging right at him than to stand up in the locker room and say, cut this crap out.
But there's still so much commitment to it. I mean, we talked with a young woman. She couldn't join us today. But, you know, she stood up against hazing of herself in her sorority. And a sorority sister later tried to run her down, she says, with a car.
Exactly. There still is this idea that the person who speaks out is a pariah. And that kind of encouragement often comes from alumni, no matter what the race, alumni who hold the purse strings in some way, or prestige, or the power of possibly giving a job recommendation or an actual job.
Allison in Medway, Massachusetts. Allison, thanks for your call.
Hi, yes. Just sort of pick up a little bit on the last point. It seems to me, just listening, that it seems to be almost exclusively a male-dominated activity, at least when you hear it in the news. I'm sure it goes on in sororities and sports teams and so on, but at least with the extremes and the violent nature of it, it seems to be so male-dominated, and I just was interested in what your guest had to say about that.
Hank, what about the gender breakdown when it comes to hazing incidents?
Well, we're looking at the deaths from 1970 to 2012. There's been a death every year, sometimes several deaths. The first death was in 1970 of a young female member taken out by pledges into the country at Eastern Illinois University. There's been
a sorority doing this?
Yes, that was a sorority.
Okay.
In terms of the deaths, we've probably had 7 or 8 female out of the 104 verified between 1970 and 2012, and there's another 8 or so that are undocumented or charged.
Does that ratio, like 8 to 100 or whatever, seem more or less the ratio of hazing prevalence between the genders?
No, the study that's done at the University of Maine, especially particularly in athletics, was showing an equal amount of hazing between men and women. And let's say at the athletic hazing level, it's equally dangerous because you've got women drinking about the same amount as men after a team party. Or number two, this new twist, the death at Utah State of a young man named Starks, where females rewarded the Sigma Nu pledge by giving him alcohol at the sorority house and elsewhere, where he died. And we've had several cases over the years where males and females together haze. This proved to be the death of a male, but you can see in many ways why that would terrify a parent about a female.
It sure would. What about this, and I think it was our caller Jay, that there's a sense of a kind of, and I mean, you up against the wretchedness and cruelty that we're hearing about, it sounds a little crazy, but there is a sense of some sort of noble tradition here. I mean, I think people think about Native Americans in sweat lodges and hanging by their pecs in some ritual ceremony of becoming men. What about all that?
Sure. Well, I start off by saying that hazing is an equal opportunity disgrace. You've had deaths in Asian groups, Hispanic groups, African American groups, and in integrated groups. But having said that, there is this this knowledge that alumni and so on are encouraging it, that because of a high-status organization, it's going to continue with people feeling that it is necessary. The highest status probably for sports in this country would be the National Football League, which has had hazing incidents every year. They're televised by ESPN and other networks and made to be cheap entertainment. Yet in 1998, a gang-like hazing at a gauntlet involving the New Orleans Saints injured Jeff Danis and Cam Cleveland in a ritual that was taken right out of a gang hazing, just like the Champion incident has evolved from a gang hazing. It needs to be stopped. Why wasn't it stopped at the NFL? Why hasn't it been stopped at the college level? And then you've got your reasons, in addition to the young people, why hazing hasn't been eradicated.
You know, you've got people all over on this. Brennan writes to us about in California's Latino, quasi-Islamic, mixed American community talking about hazing. Here's Levi. You know, he remembers 1979. He was, it looks like, in the U.S. Navy. They crossed the equator, and there is a ritual that goes along with that, which is a kind of hazing. But he says, it's a day I will cherish forever. I mean, historically, that was a very brutal hazing when sailors first crossed the equator in their career. He looks back on it, and he says he'll cherish it.
Right. The University of Texas, which is battling hazing, I spoke to the trustees just about 4 or 5 days ago on this particular issue. In that particular case of a death of a Texas cowboy, which is a booster organization, a volunteer group that follows sports and encourages sports participation and mm-hmm. fanship at yep. Texas. One of the young men said in his testimony, until the time of the death, it was the best event I had ever participated in. So, young man at the death of Chad Saucier at Auburn University, equally the same words, best experience until the time of the death that I'd ever participated in.
How do you explain that?
Some people get a feeling of accomplishment. You know, a lot of us do it from sports. You know, one of my hobbies that I just started is skydiving. It's a mm-hmm. risk factor. This kind of accomplishment, going through even the manure or the alcohol or so on, makes people think that they've passed the litmus test of manhood or femalehood, and it's more important to them, according to the studies, to be accepted by their peers than to have the approval of their coaches, their Greek advisor, or someone such as myself or you in the media.
Babette writes to us on launch. She says, I hope you include fraternity gang rape in this show. It's a common hazing ritual for a fraternity to target a girl and engage their pledges in a violent sexual assault against her, kind of manhood proving. Have you seen evidence of that?
The person who's the expert on that is Peggy Reeves Sande, who's written a book called Fraternity Gang Rape. But I have talked in an audience with other faculty members and coaches of a young woman at a New England school who cried and broke down and said for her female sports team, they had to kneel in front of male athletes on the football team and simulate a sexual act. And the line, when both the males and the females are drinking, to pass over the line is a very short, thin thread indeed.
Mike in West Palm Beach, Florida. Mike, you're on the air. Hello, Mike. Are you there, my friend?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Fine. You're on the air, Mike. What do you know?
I've had encounters like this. One of my line brothers, my LBs, was sent to the hospital. I had kidney failure, but everything turned out all right with our line. And the point I wanted to make is that they should get together, the fraternities, and set up a national council for hazing, which one member for each fraternity oversees the intake line just to make sure that there's no hazing going on.
You have some responsible person in each organization responsible for preventing it.
Exactly. Say, hey, we're here. We're not here to interfere with the intake line. We're just here to make sure that no hazing is going on and no lines are crossed, such as hazing or going too far.
Mike, I like your idea. Our time is short, but I appreciate your call from West Palm Beach. Let me get one more, if I may. Thank you, Mike. Bob in Richmond, Vermont. Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I'd like to make 2 points. Years ago, I took over a high school sports program, and when I took it over, I heard about the hazing that was going on, and it was stopped. It was stopped very quickly. I met with the team. It was stopped, done with. when I hear this stuff about these programs are supposedly trying to do something with it and they're trying to stop it and they're not stopping it, I say there was a tremendous lack of leadership. And if you have the people in power, whether it's the principals of the schools, the deans, the coaches, if they cannot stop hazing, then they should be removed. Bottom line, it's a tremendous lack of leadership, and it's just an excuse, that, you know, a poor excuse that, well, this is stuff that's been going on, and we're looking the other way. Alumni.
But make the expectation clear and non-negotiable of the leadership, you say, and maybe that's the way. Bob, thanks for that. Hank, we've just got a couple of minutes, but if you've come close to a formula for stopping it, what is it? What are the elements?
That's the one caller I completely agree with, number one, but you have a high-status male who obviously is making his point clear. But number two, the other thing about this that I keep saying till I'm blue in the face is if you're going to have a hazing policy, prove it. You know, give the maximum amount of punishments. Don't let your alumni come in and change your mind. Don't put your victim in such a position where he's influenced by others in the fraternity or exterior people in the school that he then changes his mind, or she, and retracts the charges.
You and others have written about transparent reporting. I mean, people come into universities, colleges now, to fraternities that may have had terrible things go on 9 months or a year earlier, and they just don't even know. There's no requirement very often that they're public about what's gone wrong.
That started, and that's thanks to some of the parents of victims who have died, for example, at San Luis Obispo. Well, we have Cornell, which had a death 2 years ago, now reports and names the fraternities. When I did Wrongs of Passage, the book, in 2001, there was a school at Auburn that had a list of transgressions that covered nearly a page, and the people that went into the fraternity that Chad Saucier died at were completely unaware of it, and yet at that time, Chad Saucier was not even an enrolled student. He was at a community college, and the young people knew they were breaking the rules to let him come in.
Could there not be a national policy somehow here?
There's an attempt to get a federal law passed that's been coming up over and on since the 90s and 2000s. Security on campus, which does track different kinds of crimes, has come out in favor of it. I'd be in favor of a federal law for one reason: make colleges report so we don't have to just rely on media numbers.
Much better not to simply be flying in the dark. In the case of Robert Champion, drum major at Florida A&M, brought all this to the fore again. And, of course, again, I say that hardly alone. Cases all over this country. Hank Neuer has put together a list of all the instances, a map of U.S. hazing deaths since 1838. You can see it at our website, onpointradio.org. Hank Neuer joins us today from Franklin College, author of The Hazing Reader. Hank, we really appreciate your work on this and your time today. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate the good questions. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.